apologies, paradigms, even radical ones in some cases, and the misconception that produce or engender in certain circles, as like people who don't have a capacity to think in a more complex way, you know, small minds sometimes, you know, they read, you know, through their own lens, and therefore they find, you know, too much, you know, dichotomy. You know, again, people are also very quick, especially the people who have, you know, less understanding, are very quick to, you know, to blog, which is a modern term, but to, you know, to psychoanalyze. So you've got a lot in secondary literature on the Rav, you know, which I've not studied scientifically, but just out of impression, anecdotal impression, you get a lot of, oh, he was very ambivalent, you know, he, you know, is very conflicted, you know, inconsistent, you know, and I think I mentioned last time, one of the pieces, you know, doesn't know if he's the, you know, the grandson of Brisk or the professor from Berlin, you know, both the secular, how do you, you know, manage the secular and the halachic parts, but also even, like, you know, what does he think about anything? You get all these extremes, and then, especially if you start taking all the paradigms and you take them too seriously, I mean, you lose focus of what they're really supposed to be, which is a method of expressing right ideas. A method which is very typical, you know, even conventional in halachic thinking, especially in Brisker halachic thinking, right? So instead of being a reflection of, you know, ambivalence or inconsistency, etc., on the contrary, it's like, it fits like a glove. But if you don't see that, you know, so then it becomes like, oh, you know, is the author of the Mar Nebuchadnezzar, the author of the Hachazaka, is the man who came in and gave shir three times a week, you know over four decades, you know, is he the same one who, you know, who studied in Berlin, or who uses, you know, very philosophical language, you know, very comfortably, and, you know, that's just, I think it's inexcusable, frankly. In some cases, it also has an agenda behind it, as there was in Rambam studies. In other cases, it's just out of, you know, inadequacy and ignorance. But, you know, if you really read everything, there are different perspectives and oscillation, because that's the mechanisms that the Rambam uses, and also his view of religion and view of halakha is that it's very comprehensive and very complex. And therefore, you know, there's ace, you know, le yira, ace la'ava, and ace for both. You know, in all sorts of permutations, and if that's true, so you know, you would, you know, there are two partios of the Bria. You know, we'll call it Adam One and Adam Two, not because there's any, you know, confusion about how someone is supposed to conduct himself and what his goals and aspirations are. It's a Torah's way of saying you have to develop to this side and to that side. So, but same token, the works themselves. People like say, oh, lonely man of faith, you know, ubikashta misham, which I think really is Isha Alakim, you know, that's like the Rav's more, like you said last week, the more emotional side, more expressive side, more experiential side, call it existential side, whereas, you know, Isha Alacha and let's say halachic mind are the more like, you know, cold rationalistic, you know, Lithuanian, Neo-Kantian, whatever term you want to use for it, and while the emphasis often is very different, that's part of the power of somebody who controlled all these things. And if you look at the tochen, as I said last week, there is, you know, there's all of this range in all of the works, albeit, you know, with different emphases, just like chagim have different emphases, and different mitzvahs have different emphases. That's part of the avodah. In addition to a literary style and a dramatic style, etc. Let's share a comment before we start. I don't have time to start, but you know, there was some years ago, there was like a conference here on, I don't think they called it, like the heroes of centrist Orthodox, whatever, like examining, like, who are the paradigms, you know, that made by, you know, who are the people that we, you know, see as representing this philosophy of a broader Torah, you know, way of life. you know, talking about some of their, some, there was a paper on Rav Hirsch, and there was a paper on, for sure, on the Rav, and on Rav Cook, you know, and so on and so forth, and Rav Herzog, you know, and so on. So I just remember a very fascinating comment that Rav Lichtenstein, Zichron Livracha, made at this gathering, in which he said, you know, it's a fascinating thing. If you look, if you look at Rav Cook and the Rav, so if you look superficially, you know, at their malbush, you know, and other ways that they, you know, that they, you know, external, let's say, style, so you would think the Rav was like this modern, you know, very, revolutionary, you know, person. He didn't wear a long coat. I don't know what the history of the long coat wearing exactly is in Yadus, but you know, he didn't, you know, he had kind of a beard, he had a beard, but, you know, he had, you know, he spoke, you know, English, you know, and, you know, such a magnificent English, you know, and in general, his use of terminology, language, and Rav Cook, you know, looked like an old European, you know, Rav, if you looked at him, and, you know, some of his halachic writing sounds like that too, and so on and so forth. But if you dig beneath the surface and you really examine, you know, the makshava of Rav Cook and the makshava of the Rav, the inverse is true. I mean, the Rav was a magnificent expositor and a very sophisticated, you know, expositor of, you know, what he called the philosophy of halacha. But at the end of the day, the whole goal of it is to root it in the most normative thing. And at the end of the day, he speaks about, you know, very traditional concepts, albeit just more precisely and more persuasively and more, you know, and with greater richness, let's say, and certainly greater complexity. But there's nothing in the Rav's thinking that is outside, you know, the realm of traditional hashkafa. Just far more appealing because it's far more rigorous and, you know, both stylistically and in terms of its rootedness in the halacha. Whereas Rav Cook, who was a great Talmud, I'm not saying this to disparage Kalila Rav Cook, but Rav Cook was a great man, and he was a tzaddik, and he was a big Talmud Chacham, and a student of Elazhin, and also knew Kol HaTorah Kula, and wrote, but his makshava is very mukhdash, and it's very untraditional. You could say it comes from a, you know, a very idealistic, traditional place. But the actual categories of the statement, that we know this now more than before, because originally Rav Cook's, you know, writings were filtered and edited, you know, by the Merkaz Harav people, and even then, there's plenty in there that is, you know, outside the norm. Some disturbing, frankly, and, you know, and others not, but definitely not traditional. And now we know even a little bit more because, you know, there are other ksamim, you know, that Rav Tzvi Yehuda, you know, kind of, as I say, you know, kept, quieter, and have come out. And Rav Cook has many radical views. Again, that's another topic. We can do it one day. But I think, again, out of coming from a very good place, but trying to kind of justify a generation, you know, whose conduct and behavior was very much out of step with, you know, traditional Yahadists, sometimes with secular Zionists, and so on, but whom he, out of Ahavas Yisrael, didn't want to turn his back on, or couldn't turn his back on, and therefore, you know, had to come up with certain, you know, Bakshava paradigms, you know, to explain what was happening. And this notion of, oh, you know, we live in a time that we have to be set with these challenges, the old Hashkafa, the old ways will work, we have to, you know, reassess, we have to find new vocabulary, we have to find, that is very much part of the Machshava of Rav Cook. It's not in the Machshava of the Rav. I mean, the Rav is, again, very unselfconsciously, you know, even in the Hebrew writings, you know, Ishalacha, Bikashna, Misham, clearly only written for a very learned, you know, insider kind of an audience, because they're written in not just Hebrew, but as we said before, in a very sophisticated Hebrew. How many people can read that Hebrew and really understand it? And yet he's very comfortable, you know, and there are Greek references, and there are all sorts of philosophic, you know, references, and a range, you know, there can be Aristotle and Plato, and there can be Bergson and Kant and, you know, Hegel and so on and so forth. And it's very unselfconscious. It's a way of expressing himself, maybe also a way of, you know, transmitting certain ideas to a present generation. Not so much in Ishalachan and Bikashim Bisham, certainly in his public speaking, especially on campuses and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, if you get beyond that, and I think it's a positive thing, obviously, the hashkafa itself is just a very deep examination of what the norms and values of halacha say about things. It's very, very traditional. There's nothing. There's no radical theology in the Rav that way. And I think that's important to know going forward. So, again, one of the major principles that flow from this, in a way, is the Rav's very heavy emphasis on the concept of the sower. Again, if you're a radical thinker, you know, in the sense of not how innovative you are in use of language or bringing out, you know, other dimensions of a philosophy or theology, but in terms of, like, you know, breaking from the past, you're an iconoclast, you know, kind of a person, then, you know, Masorah is not going to be one of your main or favorite. You know, you're not going to wax eloquent about Masorah. I remember I was in Eretz Yisrael a couple of years ago, and one of the yeshivas there, said to me, like, you know, where did the Rav get this? He said he'd read stuff in the Rav. Where did this Masorah thing come? Like, you know, he made that up. Then, but he meant it only, he was a fan, although I think I've limited understanding of what the Rav's, you know, Chiddush was, but when he was a fan, but he was also like, you know, like almost Messiah Hufitumo, like very innocently, like, you know, what is this? And, you know, where did it come from? And I was like looking at him, like, what? You know, the truth is, I grew up with all of this because my father was a Talmud of the Rav. You know, he was the spiritual influence of my father's life. So, you know, these were like, you know, this part of vocabulary of growing up, etc. And then I was, you know, Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein, and then a Talmud of the Rav. So it was like, you know, I didn't see, it was eye-opening to me, but in an important way, really. And the what was like this is, you know, ABCs of, you know, the religion. You know, it's like very basic, but it was eye-opening that this smart man and sincere man, who actually was a very big baki, particularly in Machshava, thought that the use of the term in this way, and terminologically might even be a little bit correct, you know, was very, and he was approvingly. Then subsequently I saw somebody showed me an article, like, written like 3-4 years ago, by an academic in Israel who I, you know, think handled, you know, the material in a very dishonest and crude and agenda-driven way. And he writes this article mostly targeting Rav Schachter, saying, oh, Rav Schachter made up this concept called Masorah. The guy writes practically this way. He made up this concept called Masorah, and he uses it to hide behind whenever he doesn't have any halachic sources, you know, to support a view. He just says Masorah, Masorah, Masorah. And there's, you know, in the history of, you know, Jewish thinking, like, there's no such thing. And then he goes on in the piece and he says, and the source of all of this, you know, whatever, is the Rav's writing where he writes about Masorah. So aside from which, like, you know, like the Imam Shach, who made it up, you know, now he's saying the Rav made it. You don't want to say it's easier to attack, you know, people who are alive than people who are not, and it's easier to attack. It's hard to attack the Rav, you know, especially now. But I thought, again, it was such a completely dishonest thing. It was like the corollary to this other experience that I had. And then I realized that it is true that, you know, in the world view that I grew up, and this yeshiva, you know, pretty much imbibes and continues, Baruch Hashem, you know, the Rav really made the concept of Masorah, you know, a centerpiece. But there was nothing innovative in it. I mean, again, he used the word probably more expansively than it had been used previously, but it's a good word. The concept isn't being used more expansively than it was used previously. It's like a linchpin in Jewish thinking. So Masorah, you know, is not simply a historic record of the past. You know, ki'ilu, we did it this way, so we're stuck. You know, know, then it's easy target. And that's how they portray it, mostly intellectually dishonestly in some cases, sincerely just out of ignorance. That's also, if you're trying to sway people's mind and you know that you don't know, it's also dishonest at the end of the day. You know, but to Ilu Tai, you take this concept, which apparently is used centrally by these people who, you know, have very strong views as to what is and is not acceptable, and you kind of narrow it and make it look, you know, ludicrous. So, oh, it just, you know, because we did it in the past, you know, we can't do it. And what about all the innovations in halacha? And is halacha really a fossil and a relic? You know, is it, you know, really something that, you know, can't adapt and can't change? Isn't that one of the, don't we want a dynamic halacha? Halacha that speaks to the times? You know, and, or, you know, some sort of, you know, nostalgic, you know, yearning, you know, for bygone, you know, days. Ah, you know, the Masorah, the Amalekite, you know, that kind of a thing. That's how they portray it. And that's not what the Rav meant by the Masorah at all. But what he really meant, this is, goes to my point, was the Rav is a very traditional thinker who was also a very innovative and creative thinker. And he felt that there was no stira between those two things. He felt that the rich foundation, you know, of, you know, for a meaningful spiritual life, was in the world of halacha, and the respect and respect for the way the world of halacha was implemented and interpreted by the great, as he used to call them all the time, Chachmei HaMesorah Shebechol Dor Vador. And that, you know, the spirit of that, both in terms of respect and reverence, you know, to each stage, as well as the spirit of adventure, the excitement, the capacity for creativity, are all part of that Masorah. Just like, again, going back to your comment a couple weeks ago, the second half of each halacha, the first half of each halacha is subordinate your will to the world, to the Rabbon Shalom, and to the world of halacha. Whether you understand it, you don't understand it, you know, you have to look at everything through that prism and, you know, redefine yourself. And then the second half is, you know, no legal institution, you know, the world has as much respect for Chiddush and personal contribution and the contributions of every generation, you know, as the halakha. That's what the Rav stood for. For him, Masorah wasn't a dead end. It wasn't just history, and it certainly wasn't just nostalgia. It was what I call a kind of an ethos. It was a sensibility. It said that in addition to, you know, the aggregate of psakim and chidushim, you know, that were said in every generation, which you know, become part of the tradition, you know, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mesinai and so on and so on. In addition to that, there's that we respect that. Torah was meant to be transmitted based on that reverence and that care and so on. And when we want to transmit it to the next generation, you know, we have to take care that sense of reverence and respect to the past and to the future, not just to the immediate narrow present, is held. But in addition to that, it's also a hashkafa, it's an ethos, meaning, you know, the Chachmei Yisrael, Shemador Vador, were more than the sum of their parts. They were what I call, based on the Gemara, walking Sifrei Torah. And therefore, they understood things based on what already was there, right, in a way that expands it. And those things are very powerful. They're different than how Sifrei Katan in the Shulchan Aruch, you know, and so on. But they're not less important. They're important in a different way. So it isn't nostalgia, and it's not the past, and it's not something we're stuck with. It is a timeless, continuous process, you know, that kind of is in and out, you know, of time. The Rav loved the concept of what he called, you know, Bergsonian time. Bergson was a philosopher who was the biggest contribution. I think he had, at one point, he had a famous debate with Einstein. Check into that. Anybody know about that? Any philosophy majors here? Anyway, Bergson, you know, his big chiddush, I guess, in philosophy was, and the Rav really loved it. Not because he loved Bergson, but he thought it was, you know, a great example of, like, putting your finger on something. It was called Bergsonian time, which is, time isn't, you know, in the moment, you know, and fleeting and gone, like all of time, you know, is a continuation. You know, so we are, you know, here, you know, connected to the past, you know, and already, you know, a bridge to the future. Sounds like just words, but that's how he explained, the Rav liked it a lot. It's how he explained things like tshuva. Tshuva should be impossible, but you can reach back and rehabilitate the past. Because the past isn't really the past. The past brought you here. It's, you know, accumulated within you. And therefore, there are things you can do to kind of... Of course, you can't not time travel. You know, you can't really go back and change the past completely, but you can change the past in that the present and future narrative will recast how we look at those, you know, what otherwise, let's say, a problematic past can be a catalyst to a, you know, more productive future, so that we won't look back at it, we will have redeemed it or rehabilitated it, even though it's in the past. That's like a tshuva idea. Or, you know, Zeicher Yetzias Mitzrayim, you know, isn't about living in the past, it's like reenacting. So for the Rav, the idea of Mesora, you know, as the past, isn't the dead fossilized past. It's the key to, you know, to building on all of that magnificence, you know, and then, you know, taking it, adding to the past, changing the past to the extent, in this way that I described before. So that's really what, you know, Mesora, you know, really is. And that's totally consistent with being somebody who is totally traditional and at the same time can be, you know, very responsive, adaptive, and even innovative, you know, in his own time. And I think that's why Mesora, like, emerged. I think people just don't get it because they just don't understand the bigger picture, or in some cases they don't have, you know, even the knowledge or the ability to understand it. But at the end of the day, this was something that appealed to the Rav very much. It's Kol Mashe Talmud Vasik Asa B'Chadash Ne'er L'Moshe Mi'Sinai. I don't know if you ever spoke about that Maimer Chazal itself, but the principle behind it is like a very powerful thing. Meaning there's a Mesora, and then, you know, sometimes the present or the future, you know, highlights, you know, the true significance of that past. Or touching the ethos of the past, you know, is what allows you to move forward in the future. If you read the Rav's stuff on policy issues, it's all what I call ethos. And if you were, a, you know, a skeptic, a Rav skeptic, let's say, and you wanted to say Nehechatesi, and we could document this at some point if you want, then, you know, you would be saying a lot of Nehechatesi. Like, you know, read the Rav, what the Rav wrote about machitzas or confrontation, you know, policy and the Jewish community issues. It all flows from his understanding of the Hashkafa of Halacha, rooted in like a very deep sense of identification with Chachmei Yisrael in the past, you know, and the needs of the present and responsibility based on the past and everything to the future. So that's what it means to be somebody who like is totally traditional and totally, you know, creative. Again, with proper limits, obviously, at the same time. So this idea, what does this have to do with what we're actually getting to? So that's why I wanted to start, because I think it is emblematic of this, you know, kind of perspective. I thought I would start at the end of Ubikashta Misham, where he has that famous piece, you know, about, you know, that story, which is very, you know, beautifully told, very poignant and in every way. But I think it's more than a story. Again, even though it was a great raconteur, and he was, you know, he was a very dramatic writer, you know. But if you heard him do these things sometimes, this is like so him. You know what I mean? And the idea of a Mesora, of the personalization, we would say, of the process of Limud HaTorah and the participation, the personalization of the participation of Chachmia Mesora Shebechol Dor Vador is something that, again, I don't think it's new. I don't think it's innovative in that sense, but the ability to present it and articulate it the way that the Rav did was just an incredible gift. And that is innovative. You know, and making it accessible is innovative. So it's fascinating, you know, to read not only the description of it and how real it is for him, but also what precedes it. So that's, I'm going to start with Corey Lemafrey a little bit, I guess, next time. It proceeds with the notion of Gilui Shechina as an ongoing revelation, which is exactly, I'm putting these things together, that's exactly what this is. Okay, I've got to run. Anyways, yeah. To be continued. Sorry, we didn't get the text. Next week, what we're going to do, we're going to start with the end of the